Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. British police say they're making strides in identifying those behind the London attack that killed 7 people and wounded 48 others, some critically. Mark Rowley is London's Assistant Police Commissioner.
And we are making significant progress now in identifying the 3 attackers and confirming the fact that there were no other suspects at the scene when the attack was carried out. Work is ongoing to understand more about them, about their connections, and about whether they were assisted or supported by anyone else. As I think you're aware, there are searches ongoing in East London, and 12 arrests have already been made.
Rowley is appealing to the public to remain vigilant and notify authorities if they notice anything unusual, no matter how insignificant they believe it may seem. The terrorist attack began with a large van driving into pedestrians on London Bridge late Saturday evening, then drove to Barrow Market nearby, where 3 attackers carried out multiple stabbings. British Prime Minister Theresa May says Islamic extremists are behind the attack.
Things need to change, and they need to change in 4 important ways. First, while the recent attacks are not connected by common networks, they are connected in 1 important sense. They are bound together by the single evil ideology of Islamist extremism that preaches hatred, sows division, and promotes sectarianism.
The London attack comes less than 2 weeks after a bombing in the British city of Manchester that killed nearly 24 people and wounded many more. It occurred just after a concert by American pop singer Ariana Grande, who will do a benefit concert today in Manchester for the families of the victims. This is VOA News. Michael Bloomberg is on a mission to ensure the United States upholds its commitments to the Paris Climate Pact, even if it is not formally part of it. President Trump recently announced the U.S. will withdraw from the Paris Agreement on climate change, saying the deal was too costly and would cause U.S. businesses to lose 7 million jobs by 2025. Bloomberg, the billionaire former mayor of New York City, has pledged up to $15 million to support the U.N. Framework Convention on Climate Change. Philippine police believe a gambling addiction led a Manila man to set fire to a casino in the Philippine capital, killing 37 people. Police have identified the assailant as Jesse Carlos, a Catholic, possibly dispelling claims by the Islamic State group that it was responsible for Friday's attack. Tens of thousands of Hong Kongers are holding a candlelight vigil on Sunday to commemorate victims of the Chinese government 1989 brutal military crackdown on protesters in Beijing's Tiananmen Square.
So I think the whole point of being here is to tell the Chinese government that this is a thing, like you have to apologize for someone else's death. And I don't believe that some of the university students say that the Hong Kong history has nothing to do with it anymore. And I don't believe in that because it is part of what Hong Kong was, and I think this is part of the process of being democratic.
Today marks 28 years since Chinese tanks rolled into crowds of demonstrators in Tiananmen Square, opening fire and killing hundreds of pro-democracy activists. Some estimates put the total number of dead in the thousands. Commemorations of the events, whether public or private, remain taboo in mainland China. Cambodia's main's opposition party made significant gains in local elections Sunday, which could threaten Prime Minister Hun Sen's grip on power. Announcing preliminary results, an opposition party spokesman said his party won about 46% of the communes. A pro-government news site said preliminary results suggested the opposition had won about a third of the communes. Official results will be announced on June 25th. And despite vowing that a renewed offensive against the Islamic State in Mosul will be a final push, Iraqi forces continue to get bogged down in ancient parts of the city where the Islamic State remains entrenched. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Here in terms of preparation, we've already covered registration of voters. We've gone very far in terms of sensitization, mobilization, and education of voters in terms of their civic rights.
Rwandans go to the polls on August 4 to choose a president.
If you look at Zambian social media space, it is awash with messages of goodwill, congratulations, and happy birthday.
The Zambian main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema celebrated his 55th birthday today, Sunday, in prison.
Police officers who are supposed to provide the protection were also involved in some of these attacks. And of course, they are the ones doing the online and phone surveillance of journalists.
And human rights groups express concern over increasing threats to the Kenyan media in the run-up to the upcoming elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Citizens in the Kingdom of Lesotho went to the polls Saturday to elect new parliamentarians. Embattled Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi dissolved parliament after some legislators from his ruling coalition defected to the opposition. Lawmakers then passed a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister. Viewers Anita Powell just returned to Johannesburg, South Africa, after covering the election in Lesotho. I reached her via telephone link up to get her take on the vote in the Southern African Kingdom.
I spent a few days in Lesotho for this election, and the voters, some the ones I talked to at polling stations, seemed pretty excited about the possibility of voting for a new parliament that will then in turn choose the new prime minister. People said, you know, this might be the third election in 5 years, but they were still optimistic that perhaps this one would be the one that does the trick and finally brings peace to Lesotho.
Anita, were there signs of tiredness from the people voting in the third election within the last 5 years?
Well, I guess, Peter, we would call this a self-fulfilling prophecy. Those who bothered to show up at the polls told me that they were very excited, that at the end of the day, the fact that they can vote is a sign that Lesotho is a vibrant democracy. However, the people who didn't show up at the polls are the ones who might have felt a little bit cynical. And I did speak to a few people who said that they voted once or twice in their lives and just didn't want to bother with it, including a factory worker I spoke to yesterday, who said she voted many years ago and she just doesn't want to bother with politicians anymore. There certainly was an element of that, but those people didn't bother to go to the polls, so it's hard to tell. What I could tell was by about 3 p.m., so 2 hours before polls closed, the stations that I had visited had reported about 50% turnout. They were going for a threshold of 85% turnout, which might have been a little bit optimistic. And it's not clear whether they hit that. We didn't hear of floods of people going in the last hour, so it seems unlikely that they got that high. From what I can tell, about 50% at least voted in Maseru.
In your report yesterday, you talked about one pretty surprising incident where you had the presence of the military at the polling stations. Can you tell me about your observation about that?
Yes. I think I used the word surprising in my report, but the interpretation by many Basutu was that this was worrying. So I went to 5 polling stations in and around the capital, Maseru, and at every single one, there was a small clutch of 5 soldiers lurking a safe distance away from the polls. Now, what's interesting about this is, you know, Lesotho's had a complicated political history where the military has been accused of getting a little too involved in politics. So for many people, this was seen as an intimidating sign that the military showed up. But in the run-up to this election, a lot of the negotiations between the parties, between the observers, seemed to indicate that we would not be seeing military at the polls. So it was very surprising to a lot of people that they did show up. We were expecting to only see police, and we were expecting that the Southern African Development Community would succeed, as they have in previous elections, in ordering the army to be confined to barracks. And that clearly didn't happen. I want to also mention that the leading opposition party, the Albasutu Convention, said that they were very worried and alarmed at the presence of soldiers at polling stations. They clearly saw it as intimidation, and so did many people I spoke to at the polling stations.
Well, Anita, did the people you spoke with say to you perhaps that the presence of the military might have contributed or might have had an impact on the voter turnout, perhaps?
You know, it really wasn't clear because there was a little bit of confusion about what the military was doing there. One thing that I thought was a little interesting, and I did speak to an army officer about this, a retired army officer, was that these guys weren't wearing name tags. And the retired army officer I spoke to said, that's a bit odd. So there was a little bit of confusion about whether these guys were LDF or not. And when I went and asked them directly, they said that they were LDF. Did that dissuade voters? We will never know, really. I didn't talk to anybody who said I didn't go to the polls because there were soldiers there. So it's hard to say.
That was VOA's Anita Powell. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Rwandans go to the polls in early August to choose a president. The National Electoral Commission says the polls will be free, fair, and credible. Charles Munyaneza, the executive secretary of the Rwandan National Electoral Commission, says the electoral body will receive nominations from candidates from June 20 to 23rd. He adds that a provisional list of qualified candidates who would participate in the elections will be declared on June 23rd. For more on the National Electoral Commission's preparation for this year's elections, I reached Charles Munyaneza in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
As you are aware, we've got elections on 3rd and 4th of August, and that means we have slightly over 2 months remaining, which means that we are far ahead in terms of preparation. We've already covered registration of voters. We've gone very far in terms of sensitization, mobilization, and education of voters in terms of their civic life, but on how they are going to be casting their votes. We've been holding consultative meetings with a number of stakeholders to make sure that the electoral process is owned by Rwandans, because we are doing this for the people of Rwanda. Therefore, we've been making sure that Rwandans are on board. Not only are we getting information on how far we've gone, but also playing an active role in terms of the activities that are taking place. Of course, in the coming few weeks, we shall be receiving starting candidates, and we're ready to put in place all the logistics, everything that's needed to make this process go on well.
How many political parties have signaled their intention to present presidential candidates or their candidate ahead of the elections?
We haven't got the intention from many political parties, because, you know, we've got registered political parties and organizations in this country. So as far as that is concerned, we are still waiting, because we started receiving these candidates on the 12th of July, and we haven't heard from many of these political parties. I think we've only heard from one political party that has already decided on who is going to be the flag bearer for that political party. But we think in the coming few days, we shall be having information on this.
Talking about educating prospective voters for this election, how has it gone so far? What mode of education are you passing these information to them ahead of the elections?
Yeah, education is very important, especially when it comes to electoral and civic education, because casting a vote is not the most important thing in itself, but the most important thing is our people are aware of the value of their vote. They are aware of the role they are supposed to play in terms of determining how they want to be governed. They are aware of the roles in place, situations in place, and they are aware of what the country expects from this process. So this is what we've been telling our people. This is what we've been educating them on. And the process is going on well. I think all Rwandans now know when the elections are taking place, not only those Rwandans here in the country, but also the Rwandans in the diaspora. So the Rwandans are ready, and we think they are prepared to cast their votes, but to do it meaningfully, knowing the value of their vote and in terms of the democratic development of the governance system in this country. So we are confident. This is not the first election we are going to have, but of course, we know each election has got its own character, but in as far as the preparations are concerned and how the feedback we are getting from the people of Rwanda, we think they are prepared and they are ready to cast their vote on the 3rd and 4th of August.
Will there be local observers as well? And will these observers, both local and international, have access across the country to deploy and be free to observe and monitor activities before, during, and after the elections?
Yes, the law is very clear on this. The law and the regulations governing elections is very clear that as long as an election observer has applied and has been accredited by the National Electoral Commission, he or she, as a person or an organization, has got the right of access to all polling stations, to casting of the vote, to the consolidation and tabulation of all election results at all levels. So this is very clear, the law is very clear, and we, as I said, have already started accrediting all these election observers, and we shall be meeting them in due course.
Charles Munyaneza is the Executive Secretary of the Rwanda National Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from Kigali. Hakainde Hichilema, the leader of Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, is 55 years Sunday. But the opposition leader celebrates his birthday in prison as he faces treason charges. UPND supporters are demanding his immediate and unconditional release, maintaining that the charges are politically motivated. They also say the treason charge is designed to intimidate Hichilema and stop him and others in the opposition from taking part in public affairs. For the latest update in the political situation in Zambia, I reached Richard Mulunga, a multimedia journalist in the capital, Lusaka.
If you look at Zambian social media space, it is awash with messages of goodwill, congratulations, and happy birthday. I've seen some few narratives circulating in WhatsApp groups. Members and supporters are happy. At the same time, it's a happy and sorrow moment that the man is celebrating his birthday behind bars. I've seen that he was celebrating that he has spent 55 years and he has spent 55 days in incarceration. So the call from Hakainde Hichilema supporters to have him released unconditionally from prison is actually gaining momentum as he celebrates his birthday in prison.
He faces serious charges, including treason, and that is why the authorities are preventing people from going to visit him. Is there any official program for him by his party, the United Party for National Development?
Nothing that we have heard of so far, but from the look of things, and that is actually what the law dictates, that when you are charged with treason, it's a capital offense. You are restricted on who visits you and what actually you do in prison, and this is what Hakainde Hichilema is facing there. He may have a very lonely birthday, perhaps with other inmates. Maybe as the day progresses, the supporters and some of the party officials can organize a birthday celebration, but with his absence, he will not feature at his own birthday celebration if anything has been organized. But nothing has been said yet from his party and his supporters.
What are you hearing from the ground, particularly when it comes to the popularity of Hakainde Hichilema? Because it appears that the more he is kept in detention, the more popular he becomes.
That is what some observers have indicated, because you realize that what is happening to Hakainde Hichilema is not anything new in Zambia. It is perhaps history repeating itself. And I would point at the late Michael Sata, when he was the biggest opposition leader in Zambia. He was arrested under the charge of motor vehicle theft, which was not bailable then, under Lady Patrick Manawasa. Sata spent 40 days in prison, and this became a bigger part of his political slogan in 2006, that I spent 40 days and 40 nights in prison, just like Jesus Christ. He spent 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. And he became very popular and ended up becoming the president of Zambia in 2011. You see, even Hakainde Hichilema is going through the same kind of torment, and if you like, they are saying it's persecution. So the more he detains under the charges that are not clear, the more he remains in prison when he was arrested at his house without an arrest warrant, and even the narratives that are coming from the trial are things that the public are not finding convincing. So he's getting more support, he's becoming more popular, and he may actually just become a president like Michael Sata did because of the incarceration.
Several people, including the European Union and other opposition parties, have called on President Lungu to intervene. He has refused to do so, saying the process has to move forward. What is he doing now? Because it appears he's unwilling to intervene.
Indeed, the president has been engaged by local people here and other international, multilateral and bilateral institutions. And he has stood his ground that he cannot interfere in the due process of the court, the due process of the law. He says he would rather follow the law than, intervene in the wake of the judiciary here. So the narrative continues. People are still calling on upon the president that he has got the powers. He is the chief executive of the country, and he can bring this whole narrative to a halt. Zambia can focus on other socio-economic activities such as developing our democracy, bring development in the country, building hospitals and supplying these social services in education, in health, and so on and so forth.
Richard Mulonga is an independent Zambian multimedia journalist. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Sudanese Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi Saturday in a turnaround following recent tensions. It was not clear if trade embargoes imposed by each side on the other would be lifted, but the Sudanese Foreign Minister insisted that efforts were being made to resolve the dispute over the imposition of visas on Egyptian nationals. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Ties between Egypt and Sudan appeared to be on the mend Saturday following a belated visit to Cairo by Sudanese Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour. Gandour had been scheduled to meet with top Egyptian officials earlier in the week, but the visit was postponed amid a public spat between the presidents of both countries. Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir had accused Egypt last month of supporting armed militants in both South Sudan and Darfur, claiming that Egypt had supplied them with armored vehicles. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi denied the claim, while Egyptian media accused Sudan of supporting terrorists in southern Libya following a recent terror attack, which left several dozen Coptic Christians dead in the south of the country. Sudanese Foreign Minister Gandour told a news conference following his meeting with President Sisi that it was difficult for a country like Sudan, with lengthy borders, to control everything that was flowing in and out of the country, but that joint efforts are being made with Khartoum's neighbors to prevent terrorists from infiltrating.
أكثر من 1,200 كيلومتر من الحدود لن تستطيع دولة أن تقوم بحراستها. نعرض.
He says that Egypt and Sudan share a 1,200-kilometer land border and that it is virtually impossible to control the entire length of it. But he insists Khartoum is proposing to Egypt similar arrangements that it has with neighbors Chad and Ethiopia to set up joint border patrols to monitor what is going in and out. He argues that such an agreement with Chad has reduced the flow of militants in and out of the country. Gandour noted that trade and consular disputes between both countries were also being studied by joint delegations to try and resolve them. He claimed that the imposition of visas on Egyptian nationals stemmed from Egyptian complaints about the flow of terrorists into Sudan. It was not clear if any progress was made in resolving the dispute, however. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry, for his part, tried to downplay recent friction between the two sides, arguing that both countries were trying to open a new page in cultural security and economic relations.
وليس بأي حال من الأحوال أن مصر أي فائدة على الإطلاق من أي شيء.
He says that Egypt has absolutely no interest in doing anything that would harm Sudan, and that a strong Sudan was in Egypt's interest, and vice versa. Landur said that the peoples of both countries have a long history of friendship, and he urged both sides not to do anything that would poison the relations between our two peoples. Both Egypt and Sudan were united under the Egyptian monarchy, which was deposed by a revolution led by Egyptian military officers in 1952. Sudan officially became independent after a referendum in 1956. Landur told journalists that both Egyptian President Sisi and Sudanese President Bashir had met 18 times in recent years, which he stressed is more than the leaders of any other neighboring states. Ties between Egypt and Sudan have also been strained in recent years over an Ethiopian project to build a dam on the Nile River. Ethiopia and nations upstream have argued that the agreement was unfair and needs to be revised. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Human rights groups are expressing concern over an increasing number of threats to media groups ahead of the Kenyan general election on August 8th. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Speaking at a recent gathering in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, representatives from Human Rights Watch and Article 19 blamed authorities in the East African nation for allegedly committing a range of abuses against journalists reporting on sensitive issues threatening freedom of expression ahead of the August polls. Otsiemo Nyamaya, Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, explains.
Police officers who are supposed to provide the protection were also involved in some of these attacks. And of course, they are the ones doing the online and phone surveillance of journalists. In some cases, the police officers arbitrarily arrested journalists, intimidated them, harassed them, and threatened them.
In a 53-page report titled Not Worth the Risk, the two groups claimed that police have rarely investigated attacks or threats against journalists. Since President Uhuru Kenyatta took office in 2013, researchers said there is no evidence that any security officer or public official has been held accountable for threatening, intimidating, or physically attacking a member of the media in Kenya. Journalists and bloggers reporting on corruption, disputed land acquisition, counter-terrorism operations, and the 2007-2008 post-electoral violence, among other sensitive issues, have faced intimidation and beatings. Henry Miner is the regional director of Article 19 Eastern Africa.
We're also asking the Inspector General of Police to ensure prompt, thorough, independent, effective investigations. When Nehemiah Okwemba and team were attacked, he said, we have instituted a committee that will investigate this. This is nearly a year down the line. There isn't a report about the investigation. Nobody has been held to account.
But senior government officials say they recognize the pivotal role played by the media in promoting democratic process. Joe Musheru is Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Information and Communication Technology.
As a country and an emerging democracy in Africa, we would not allow ourselves to harass or gag the media, and will continue to support all initiatives of media stakeholders in their pursuit for professionalism and responsibility. We, however, note with regret the reported but isolated instances where journalists have been harassed, beaten, or even lost their lives in the line of duty. This situation is unacceptable. I want to assure you that the government is determined to protect the media working space and will take punitive measures against those who direct violence against reporters.
According to the report, Human Rights Watch and Article 19 interviewed 92 journalists, human rights activists, bloggers, and government officials throughout Kenya. They documented 17 incidents in which 23 journalists and bloggers were physically assaulted between 2013 and 2017 by government officials or individuals believed to be aligned with them. Reuben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Under-20 World Cup in South Korea. African champions Zambia came from behind to beat Germany 4-3 after extra time and advanced the quarterfinals of the Under-20 World Cup in South Korea. Zambia were leading 3-1 in the 89th minute, but late goals from Suat Sada and Jonas Awila ensured the game went to extra time. Zambia will now play Italy in the last eight on Monday after the Italians beat France 2-1 in the second round clash. Meanwhile, Senegal's young Lions of Teranga were knocked out on Thursday after a 1-0 defeat to Mexico. A goal in the 89th minute from substitute Ronaldo Cisneros was the difference between the two sides in Incheon. The West Africans finished the game a man down following Alon Guye's expulsion for a second book of offense after 71 minutes. Senegal also went into the match without two key players, defenders Kevin Dian and Solemai Au, who were both suspended. Mexico will now face England in the quarterfinals on June 5th in Chionan. In the African Champions League, Mozambique's Beira won their first ever African Champions League group match as they beat Sudan's El Merrick 1-0. Dai Antonio scored the only goal of the match on Saturday for hosts Beira on 67 minutes, while Merrick ended the game with 10 men. Ala Eldin Youssef was sent off in the final minute of the match for second book of offense. In Saturday's other match, Zanaco scored late to beat Cameroon's Cotton Sport 2-1 in Zambia. On Friday, defending champion South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns lost in the last minute to Esperance of Tunisia. The other two sides in the group play on Sunday as St. George of Ethiopia, who have two draws so far, host DR Congo's AS Vita Club as they search for their first point of the group stages. In Group B, there was a shock win for Al Ahli Tripoli of Libya as they beat Caps United of Zimbabwe 4-2 in Harare. In the other Group B match on Friday, Egypt's Zamalek were held to a 1-1 draw by Algerian side USM Alger. Last year's runners-up needed a late goal to earn a point, with Zambia striker Emmanuel Mayuka scoring for the Egyptians in injury time. That draw means Zamalek remain top of the group with 5 points, Al Ahli Tripoli and USM Alger both have 4, while Caps United are still in contention with 3 points. Turning to the Confederation Cup, Derek Nsibambi scored twice for Uganda's KCCA to earn them a 2-1 win over Nigeria's Rivers United in Kampala on Saturday. The other match in Group A was played on Friday, and Morocco's FUS Rabat came from behind to beat visiting Club Africain of Tunisia 2-1. The results mean that after 3 group matches, FUS and KCCA both have 6 points, while Rivers and Club Africain are on 3. Also on Saturday in Group D, there was a 1-0 win for Guinea's Horoya away in Gabon against Monana. Holder TP Mazembe of DR Congo hosts SuperSport United of South Africa on Sunday in the other Group D encounter. Both sides are on 4 points from 2 games. On Friday in Group B, Swaziland's Mbabane Swallows earned a goalless draw with visiting Mamelodi Algea of Algeria. The draw keeps Mamelodi at the top of Group B with 5 points and Mbabane second, a point behind. Three-time winners CS Sfaxien can overtake both teams if they beat South Africa's Platinum Stars in Tunisia late on Sunday. Finally, in tennis, Andy Murray saw off Argentina's Juan Martin Del Potro with a superb straight set win to reach the fourth round of the French Open. The world number one won a gripping 84 minutes opening set on his way to a 7-6, 7-5, 6-0 victory. The Scot now goes on to face American Joe Isner or Russia's Karen Khachanov. British number two Kyle Edmund's run came to an end with a defeat by big serving Kevin Anderson in five sets. The South African fought back to win 6-7, 7-6, 6-1, 6-4 in a near four-hour match. Anderson, who was a top 10 player before being hampered by a series of injuries, will now meet 2014 US Open champion Marin Cilic in the fourth round. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Dear. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ingekuwa maliwe, ingekuwa dada, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika,
pesa za somo wa roho yangu, pesa za
akuwaza kidege, kidege akuwaza kidege. Ingekuwa maliwe, ingekuwa dada, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ingekuwa maliwe, ingekuwa dada, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika.
The poor people.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Recently, the government of China has launched and is implementing what is called the Belt and Road Initiative. The idea is to promote China's trade with Asia, Europe, and Africa, and is now being implemented with the pledge of $1 trillion. A few months ago, the Chinese president hosted a global summit meeting on the Belt and Road Project, well attended, an indication that many governments are interested in this massive infrastructure project. The idea now is for China to follow the ancient Silk Road that linked China with the rest of Asia as well as Europe. Now it has turned its attention to what is called the Silk Road across the ocean and focusing now on East Africa. Last week, the Chinese project of building a rail link between the port of Mombasa, the Indian Ocean, and Nairobi was launched by the president of Kenya. And the idea then is to continue a second stage, which will then move from Nairobi to the borders of Uganda. When the project was conceived, there was a meeting with all the heads of state of East Africa and Central Africa, and they pledged to make some changes in their rail system to link with that of Kenya. The idea then is to promote inter-African trade. We should also bear in mind that just recently also, China concluded a rail link between Ethiopia, a landlocked country, with the port of Djibouti, and that railroad is up and running. Even though everyone realizes this railroad, which replaces the 100-year-old British railroad, which was small grade, 2.5 inch, will be of enormous help to Kenya, because this new railroad will be faster and will carry more goods, and with industrial bases in Mombasa and Nairobi, there are critics in Kenya that it is a very costly project, $3.3 billion, with China financing 90% and Kenya 20%. The other controversial issue is that this project was supposed to be inaugurated at the end of the year and not now, as was done last week. And there are critics that because elections are due in Kenya soon, that the government is exploiting that. But we must also bear in mind that Africa does need major infrastructural projects, and we should therefore welcome this new fast rail project between Mombasa and Nairobi. It also reminds us of the colonial period, where the infrastructures were all planned to move commodities from the areas that they were being gathered to the seaports. This is very true, not only in the settler countries like Kenya and Uganda, but in West Africa, where we have poor infrastructure because the colonial powers were more interested in removing commodities to the home countries for manufacturing. So this is welcome, and China should be encouraged, even though there are critics that call it neo-imperialism. But frankly, somebody should come in to improve the infrastructure of Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Mr. Tino, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when a wealthy leader runs out of words, it is money that does the talking. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past 3 years, well over 3 million Iraqis have been displaced from their homes by ISIS. But even as Iraqi armed forces and their global coalition allies continue to uproot ISIS from the territory it once occupied, landmines and unexploded ordnance threaten those refugees who would return to their homes. As ISIS retreats, they are leaving behind thousands of deadly explosive hazards, particularly around critical infrastructure like power and water utilities. Before Iraqi families can return home and rebuild their communities, these hazards must be thoroughly cleared, wrote Rachel Chen in a recent blog post. Ms. Chen works in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs at the State Department's Office of Congressional and Public Affairs. The disposal of landmines, improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, and unexploded ordnance is necessary to help stabilize areas liberated from ISIS and make them habitable again. And this effort presents its own set of challenges. In the past, humanitarian clearance of explosive hazards began once the fighting stopped. These days, much of the clearance takes place in inhabited urban areas close to active conflicts. That means that civilian deminers work side by side with military personnel. Humanitarian clearance operators are neutral parties concerned with protecting civilians, wrote Ms. Chen. Working closer to conflict often requires extra measures to maintain that neutrality. Or take the myriad of IEDs, a favorite weapon of ISIS fighters. Some are workshop-made, identical devices produced by the dozen, while others are put together on the spot by experienced bomb-makers. Such unique IEDs are particularly tricky for humanitarian clearance operations. Since 2003, the United States has invested more than $300 million toward the clearance and safe disposal of explosives and weapons in Iraq. Through the State Department's Political Military Bureau's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement, the U.S. government works with a combination of humanitarian mine operators and contractors to clear explosives from areas liberated from ISIS. Humanitarian clearance operations are vital to protecting civilians on the edges of conflict, wrote Rachel Chen. The United States urges the international community to work together on these important efforts, dedicated to making communities safer and enabling civilians to return home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.